All right. Well, thank you all for coming. In Yana Dioma, before we start off the Pesach season, it's not a coincidence that this week's parsha is Parsha Sachodesh. It's not a coincidence because I'm not sure if the video explicitly. I don't know if the video explicitly said it, but eclipses or solar eclipses always happen around Rosh Chodesh. And so either on Rosh Chodesh or the day before, depending on when the Molad is. But because in particular this is Parsha Sachodesh, where we celebrate the Jewish people following the lunar calendar as opposed to the solar calendar, I think that there's a particular significance for the coming Rosh Chodesh Nisan and the solar eclipse. So if you turn to page one, I'm just going to share it on the screen so people on Zoom can also see it. So these are pictures of the eclipse. If any of you have had a moment or two or have a few moments later to watch the video, if you don't know how an eclipse works, the short version is that the sun is X distance away from the earth. The moon is X distance in between the earth and the sun. And so what can sometimes happen is that the moon can cast a shadow or can block some of the light from the sun, creating a shadow on Earth. So that's what we call a solar eclipse. The opposite is a lunar eclipse, when you have the Earth blocking the sun's shadow onto the moon. So then you have a lunar eclipse. But we're going to be talking about solar eclipses. So the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun is. However, because of the way the moon is positioned in terms of its distance between Earth and the sun, they actually appear to be the same size when it comes to reflecting the light. So theoretically, if things line up, like they do every few years, you get a total or full solar eclipse, where the moon completely blocks out or occludes the sunlight. What happens then, if you look in the picture above it, is it's very, very eerie. You can read descriptions, or maybe you saw it. Basically, the entire sky grows dark. It gets colder. Sometimes it becomes very, very dark or pitch black, and you see this just black circle with a halo of light, which is very dangerous to look at unless you have the proper glasses to see the corona of the sun. So there we go, corona. People not being concerned, but please do wear glasses. Sometimes, however, you can get interesting colors. The Gemara will talk about it. Depending on the angle of the sun and the angle of the moon, sometimes it turns red. The sky, depending on what time of the day it is, what position everything is, it can turn blue or purple or yellow. There are really interesting pictures you can find online. I wasn't going to print all of them, but they're really, really beautiful. And as we'll see, the Gemara says that the significance of the colors is actually not an accident, but depending on the colors that you see, there's different signs that the eclipse is portending. And in terms of us, next week on August 8th, so if you see on the picture on the bottom right, so there is a certain path that the eclipse will follow. We're not going to be in the full eclipse, so it's not going to be completely dark. But around, I would say, between 3 and 3:20 is when we'll get 75% occlusion. It will get a little darker. The sun will be blocked out a little bit. If you drive up north to Rochester or Burlington or Buffalo, it will be a total eclipse. And so the question that I want to explore with you is, what does Yiddishkeit, what does Judaism have to say about this? Is there halachic implications? Are there hashkafic implications? And also one, I guess, element of both of those is to look at how previous generations or Jewish generations experienced eclipses. So hopefully we'll do the first part will be halacha, the second part will be hashkafa, and the third part will be history. So the first part that I want to talk about is halacha. The major halachic, or one of the major halachic questions is, do we make a bracha or not? So anybody that's seen an eclipse before, have you made a bracha?
About 15 years ago. just on the first day.
So Birchas Hachama is mentioned in the Gemara. That's when, according to some calculations, the sun is in the original place where it was when the world was created. Whether that is scientifically, historically accurate is a machlokas in the Gemara. But there's a special bracha. For an eclipse, though, the Gemara doesn't mention. Now, they certainly had eclipses in the times of the Gemara. And so the question that we'll have to talk about is, why is there no bracha mentioned, and should things change now? So if you look in source number one, this is the Shulchan Aruch from Hilchos Brachos. So it talks about the different brachos that you make on natural phenomena. Al hazikin, on comets, v'hu kamin kochav hayore kecheitz ba'orech ha'shamay mimakom lemakom v'nimshach oro kashevet. And so it's defining what zikim are, because it's a debate. So they say that it's a star that shoots across the sky like an arrow, and there's this tail of light, like a rod, that follows it. So it's a comet. V'al ra'adas ha'aretz, and on earthquakes. V'al habrakim, and on lightning. V'al ha'ra'emim, and on thunder. V'al ruchos shenashvu bizaf, and very, very strong winds. I'll call echad me'elu on all of these cases, mivarech baruch ata Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam osem aseh breishis. We make an osem aseh breishis. V'im yirtze, and if you want, yomar, you can say instead, baruch ata Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam shekocho gvuraso malei olam, the other bracha. So we say for lightning, osem aseh breishis, it's an incredible phenomenon. And for thunder, we say shekocho gvuraso malei olam, where we highlight God's strength. But there are other times when theoretically we should be making brachos, when you see a comet. Yeah.
When they say big winds, would that mean a hurricane or a tornado?
Yeah, so that's the question. The question is exactly what are these big winds? And many people say that we don't really know how to define it anymore, and so most people kind of hold off. I would personally, I think if you see a tornado, like a full tornado with the funnel, I think you can say it. I think you should also run away as fast as you can, but not be like one of those storm chasers. But theoretically, if you see it in real life with the full funnel, I would say it. Hurricanes, again, they're difficult to gauge. Well, what category hurricane? Where am I standing in the hurricane? The general rule that I was given by my Rebbeim is that if you are, the Hebrew word is nispa'el, if you are moved by it, if you're moved by the awesomeness of it, so then you can make a bracha. One thing that's missing here, though, which is also a celestial phenomenon, are eclipses. So the question is, why don't we make a bracha on an eclipse? What are some reasons why we wouldn't make a bracha on an eclipse? What would be different about it? So one of the most common answers that's given is that, as we'll see in the Gemara, it was a bad sign. Comets were a bad, not comets, eclipses were a bad sign. If you go back in basically any mythology, the stories are always different, but people were deathly afraid of eclipses. In the Native Americans, a jaguar was eating the sun or eating the moon. In China, it was a dragon. In Greece, the Greeks were angry. The gods were angry at the mortal king, so they would hide the sun. Every single mythology had their own story and explanation as to why the eclipse occurred, but it was never good. And that's very intuitive, because we rely on both the sun and the moon for light, for heat, for calendars, for basically all the world to function normally. Also, if you're standing in a full eclipse area, all the animals think that it's night. So all the cows, like, it's that you could see videos, all the cows just like start making funny noises or walking back to their resting places. Crickets come out because they think it's night. Animals go to sleep. It's very eerie. And so they would get really freaked out by this stuff. So in Judaism, we also believe that eclipses, the Gemara says, are also not a great thing. If you look in source number 3, the translation's on the following page. So the Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, Bizman Shehacham Aloka, Simin Ra L'chol HaOlam Kulo. At the time when the sun is struck, is hit, which we'll define for now as an eclipse, it is a bad sign for the entire world. We won't go into the whole thing. There's another opinion that says that it's just bad for the Jewish people. Doesn't really matter. Go now, turn the page to the second section. This describes the difference between a solar eclipse and a lunar eclipse. Tanu Rabbanan, Bizman Shehacham Aloka, when the sun is struck, Simin Ra Leovdei Kochavim. It's a bad sign for idol worshippers. Levan Aloka, if the moon is struck, if the moon gets an eclipse, Simin Ra Lesoneihem Shel Yisrael. It's a sign, it's a bad sign for the quote-unquote haters of the Jews, which is a euphemism for the Jewish people. Mipnei sheYisrael monim laLavana vaOvdei Kochavim lechama. The difference being because Jewish people follow the lunar calendar, so when their source of daily life is disrupted, it's a bad sign for them. The non-Jewish world follows the solar calendar, so when their celestial object is struck, so that's a bad sign for them. So this is where people start seeing, well, maybe because it's a bad sign, maybe we shouldn't be making brachos on bad signs. Now, there's a problem with that. Why is there a problem with that? What would seem to be a proof against that idea? What brachos do we make on bad things? Right, so the most classic one is Dayan Emes. When we get bad news, we say Dayan Emes. Now let's go to natural phenomena. What bracha do we make on things that are a bad sign? Or theoretically a bad sign? Rainbows, yeah. Right? We say Zocher HaBris V'Ne'eman B'Vrisov V'Kayam B'Ma'amaro. Now, in a certain sense, we're thanking Hashem for not destroying the world, but the rainbow is a sign of Hashem basically saying, you guys deserve to be destroyed, but I'm not going to because I made a promise to Noah thousands of years ago. But there are halachos. You're not supposed to tell people there's a rainbow. You're not supposed to stare at it for too long. You look at it, you make a bracha, and then you move on. So everybody says, well, why can't I stare at it? There are different cases where it might be mutter. But in general, you're not supposed to go looking for rainbows. There's no pot of gold there. That's another example where theoretically we have a bad sign, and nevertheless, we make a bracha on it. And if you go back to source number 2, if you go back to the first page, there's a Rashi in Chulin. Rashi says, Zikim, Vizos, Viramim, Viruchos, all of those things, all of those celestial phenomena that we spoke about in the previous Gemara, the comets and thunder and lightning and wind, Dekula Naklala, they're all bad stuff. So again, I'm not sure about the comet part, but all those other things, forget about supernatural or astrological. When there's thunder and lightning, it's usually not a good thing for people. When there's strong winds, it's usually not a good thing for people. When there are earthquakes, it's usually not a good thing for people. And nevertheless, we make brachos on these things. So the Chazon Ish is reported to have said that the reason why we don't make brachos on an eclipse is because, Reb Chaim Kanievsky said that the reason why we don't make brachos on eclipses are because it's bad news. But all these things are bad. All these things are bad. So why should eclipses be any different where we don't make a bracha, but all these other things we do? And for that reason, there are some people that say, well, maybe we should be making brachos. I personally, the way we could justify that opinion is to say that those are really different things. Putting the rainbow aside. Now, the rainbow, you could say, well, we have a special haftacha for that. We have a special promise that nothing bad is actually going to happen. So that's not a problem. Dayan ha-emes is something bad that already happened. The thunder, the lightning, the earthquakes, all of that is bad stuff that's happening right now. The eclipse is not something bad inherently. It's something bad that could be coming. It's signaling there's something bad on the horizon. So that might be different. We don't make brachos on a sign of something bad to come. Why? Because we're supposed to change it. We're supposed to do tshuva. That's why the practice of some gedolim, when they would see eclipses, was to daven and to say tehillim. And it's documented. There are different rabbanim that would say you should say tehillim, you should daven. But that could be one reason. For bad stuff that already happened, so what do? I say, dayan ha'emes. I say, wow, this was very powerful. I wish it didn't happen. But for something that's saying something bad is going to happen, so I'm not making a bracha on that. I should try to change it. Yeah.
Since eclipses are mathematically calculated and they come on somewhat of a set schedule, I really don't understand what you consider a deadline.
Right. So that is the million-dollar question that ever since the 1600s, people have been struggling with. So as you correctly pointed out, eclipses are natural phenomenon. So how could you say it's a bad sign if we know when they're going to happen? So why is that contingent on what we do? And if you keep going in the Gemara, on page number 2, to the last part, below the picture of the eclipse, it says, Tanu Rabbanan, Bishvil Arba Dvarim Chamaloka. There are four reasons, or because of four things, the sun is struck. Al Av Bezdin Shemes Ve'eno Nispad Kahalacha. Gadol Hador, the head of the Sanhedrin, dies. The religious leader of the Jewish people dies, and they're not given the proper respect by their funeral. A betrothed girl that's raped in the city, and she cried out, and nobody saved her. Val Mishkav Zachar, an act of homosexuality. Val Shnei Achen Shenishpach Daman Keechad, and two brothers who were killed together. So for those four things, we get eclipses. So what does that sound like? It sounds like that those are the sins that bring forth an eclipse, that make Hashem bring an eclipse. And in fact, if you go back to the previous paragraph, the second underlined part, it says, Ubizman sheYisrael osin ritzon hashamakom ein misyarin mikol elu. And if the Jewish people are doing good, you don't have to be afraid. So it sounds like that it really depends on what we do. If we do good, then no problems. If we're doing bad, then Hashem brings eclipses. So how can that be if it's a natural phenomenon? And apparently, I haven't seen documentation of this, but apparently this was one of the, arguments that people that would make fun of and dispute Chazal and say, oh, I don't need to follow the Torah because they didn't know what they were talking about. This was one of the arguments that they marshaled. And the reason is because starting in the 15 and 1600s, there were Rabbanim that wrote apologetics trying to explain it and say there are people that make fun of the rabbis because they said they don't know what they're talking about, but they're really wrong, and we have to understand the Gemara differently. And there's a number of approaches to how to deal with it. Before we get to that, though, I just want to finish up the halachic section. That's one reason why we wouldn't have to make a bracha, is because maybe it's portending bad news. Why it would portend bad news, if it's a natural phenomenon, we'll get to in a second. There is another, more technical reason why we don't make the bracha, and that's because it's not mentioned in the Gemara. The Gemara just didn't mention it for whatever reason. The sages didn't want to. And even now, if we might be moved by it, it doesn't matter. We can't make a bracha on it. And there's a number of natural phenomena that aren't mentioned in the Gemara. Volcanoes, for example. Waterfalls. Stalactites. All of these are natural phenomena that are very wondrous to us, and yet we don't make brachos on them. The Gemara says if you see a big mountain, if you see a big ocean, you make Osem Asa Bracious. If you see the Atlantic Ocean for the first time in 30 days, maybe you would make an Osem Asa Bracious. If you see Mount Everest, you make Osem Asa Bracious. So maybe for those things, we can have analogs. If you see the Rocky Mountains, so you make an Osem Asa Bracious. But Niagara Falls, or if I go to Hawaii and I see a volcano erupt, Why don't I make an Osa Masa Bracious? So there's one school of thought that says you do. And you want to know why the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch don't mention them? Because they didn't have volcanoes there, or the waterfalls that they had weren't so impressive. Or the stalactites that they have weren't that impressive. If you go to Luray Caverns, that's impressive. So you make an Osa Masa Bracious. That is one school of thought. That's the opinion of Rav Shmuel Vosner. Rav Shmuel Vosner says that any natural phenomenon that moves you, that's not mentioned in the Gemara, you can make an Osa Masa Bracious on if it moves you. The other, I guess, opinion is that, no, I don't know why the sages didn't make that takana or not, but it doesn't even matter. Maybe the only reason why they didn't make that takana is because they didn't have volcanoes near them. But so what? Chazal didn't make a mitzvah for that. Chazal are the ones that created brachos, and they said, in this case you make a bracha, in this case you make a bracha. Even though had there been volcanoes, they would have said make a bracha. They didn't. And so no matter what the reality is, they didn't permit a bracha, so we can't just go ahead making brachos up. That's the opinion of the Chazanish's or the Stipler's school of thought. And again, I think there are really valid opinions on either side. So if someone would come to me and say, I really want to make an Osa Masa Bracious on a volcano that erupted, that I see erupted, I would say maybe it's better to say it without the Shem Hashem. We'd say, you know, Baruch Osa Masa Bracious. If you really want to say the full Baruch, I don't think it's the end of the world. But even Rav Shmuel Vosner, when he was asked about an eclipse, he said, I don't know. I don't want to get into that.
Can't you just imagine all the sermon that would be written on what's the shear of the eclipse?
Uh-huh.
How big an eruption?
Yeah. So if I see only, if the magma doesn't spurt up, it just flows out. Yeah, so again, I don't know. This is all in footnotes from Svarim, where he said, Rav Shmuel Vosner told me personally that he wouldn't make a bracha on an eclipse, or he has to think about it. So the consensus of Poskim is that on an eclipse we don't. Either because it's a bad sign, or even if it's not a bad sign, for some reason, Chazal didn't make a takana to say that bracha, and we don't have the authority to make up new ones. And even in cases where we might, there still have this principle of safek brachos lahakel. So if you're really moved by the eclipse, I would say it without a shem Hashem, if you really, really want to. But most people don't. I asked Rabbi Willig what he does, and he said safek brachos lahakel, no bracha. That's the opinion of Rabbi Willig. Now, let's move on to Mark, what you were asking, which is, how do we deal with this natural phenomenon, being able to calculate it? So what do we do? So the Maharal is probably the earliest to deal with it. He gives an answer which some more modern scholars believe is mathematically incorrect. So I'm not going to go into that one. The first one that we'll talk about in chronological order is Rav Yonasan Eibshitz, who wrote the Yaros Dvash. He lived 1696 to 1764. He has a very fascinating answer. He says, "Ukvar hivinu rabim ze hakavana belikoi hu hanigud shekorin likoi chama likoi levana." So many people think that when the Mishnah and Gemara talk about likoi chama and likoi levana, it refers to eclipses. "V'lakach tzachaku tzeirim al divrei chazal," and they laugh about the sages. "Shedavar ze tivihu al pi cheshbon," because it's natural and you're able to calculate it. "V'yachal adam lachshav mehayom ad sof ha'olam," you can calculate it from now to the end of days, when and where there will be eclipses. He, however, has a different opinion. If you turn the page to the bolded part, he has an interesting deal. He says, what is the Hebrew term? It's called likui. What does likui mean? To hit. The sun is struck. The moon is struck. So the way we explained it before, what struck means is basically punched out of existence. But Rav Yonasan Eibshitz says, And this is an assumption, even if they don't say it explicitly. By the time of the Gemara, everybody knew what eclipses were. Everybody knew that eclipses were caused by, or people in the world of the Gemara and the Mishnah, the Roman Empire, the Greeks, the Egyptians, they all knew it was caused by shadows. So Rav Yonasan Eibeshit says, the metaphor is off. Likui means you're doing something to the celestial body. But that's not what's happening. What's happening is something's just blocking it. He says, V'chi halikui b'ner, halo haner mavik oro, are you hitting a candle? No, the candle is still lit. Mibli chisaron, nothing's impacting the candle. Rak chisaron b'mekablim, the only reason why it's not light for us is because there's something in our way. Sheyesh kan davar chotzeitz, there's a chatzitza, there's something blocking. So he says the metaphor that the Gemara used is off. So if you go to the next bold part, he says, Ach be'emes, hu kach kasher darashti kvar ki lif'amim, nimtza b'chama atzma k'samim gedolim. There are stains. I've mentioned this many times, he says. There are stains that appear on the sun. Kasher matzu bizmanim b'klei habata, that they've found when they have telescopes. U'k'samim elu ein lahem siba, and there's no reason for them. There's no rationale for them. And he says, and nobody can predict when they'll come. And then he asks, well, those spots on the sun, those stains on the sun, well, if we can only see them with a telescope, so how could the Gemara have been talking about them? And he says, well, they had much more sensitive eyes. They lived close. They lived a more natural life. We have more machinery. We have more urban life. We're not so sensitive to changes in the sun and changes in the moon. So the natural world and people in the ancient world, they could tell the difference. We can't. We need telescopes. But that's what the Gemara means. Not eclipses, stains on the sun, which are sunspots. Sunspots. Those were first discovered in Europe in the 1600s. This was a new thing that apparently Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz was really into. And if you look at the picture, so if you're looking from a telescope from Earth, the picture on the right is what it looks like. There are these blotches. And so the imagery then really works. If you hit somebody, they get a black and blue mark. So it looks like somebody hit the sun. And so in reality, what is it? It's a magnetic flare. The sun's magnetic field basically causes an eruption. And that's what makes it look to us like it's a spot. But even though we might understand the reasoning behind it, there is still a large degree of unpredictability. If you look in source number 5, this is from Stanford University, in the bolded part it says, one knows the rate with which they will appear to produce the expected number of sunspots, but you can't really predict when the next one will appear. Even to this day, we don't know when and where sunspots will appear. Once we know, we can then calculate, okay, based on certain measurements, this is how many we should expect to see. But when and where it's going to pop up, we don't know. Now, there's two problems with Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz's pshat. The first one is, again, he anticipates it. He says, well, people's eyes were much more sensitive back then. So many rabbanim and many scholars are like, nah, it's a cop-out of an answer. What are you talking about? But if you look in source number 6, I found this today. This is a journal in the British Astronomical Association from about 17 years ago. They quote a letter of Theophrastus. Theophrastus was a student of Aristotle, and he wrote a treatise on weather. He says, if the sun rises when it has a black mark, it is a sign of rain. And so this journal article basically runs some calculations and agrees with earlier literature that it is probable that Theophrastus' references to sunspots were observations made by early Greek astronomers. And so Theophrastus and Aristotle lived 350 BCE, way before the Gemara was around. And so it's entirely possible that maybe not everybody could see sunspots, but apparently some people could. Yeah, but they had telescopes. I don't think they were as... I don't think...
sophisticated. The Gemara makes a reference.
The Gemara makes a reference to sunspots or telescopes?
Telescopes.
Yeah. No, you're 100% right. They had telescopes back then. They just weren't as powerful. So you had this gap during the Middle Ages where, like, people, I think the first recorded sunspot sighting in Europe was, I have it printed out upstairs. I think it was like the year 1000 or 1100. Until then, people weren't really able to see them. But apparently, back in the times of the Greeks, they could. Either maybe they had slightly more sophisticated instruments, or they were just more adept at seeing them. They were more in tune with the natural world. And in fact, we have on the other side of the globe, in China and Korea and Japan, so we have references to sunspots also later, in like the year 800. So a few years beforehand, a few before Europe did. Some claim there was even a little bit earlier, like 25 BC, around the time of Julius Caesar and the Roman occupation. But at that time, there really is evidence that people had sunspots. So that particular question on Rav Yonos and Eibeshitz could theoretically fall away, that maybe there were sunspots and maybe that's what the Gemara meant. The only problem with that is that that's only half of the Gemara, right? In addition to Likui Chama, there's also Likui Levana. There are no moon spots. And the craters and the light spots and the dark spots on the moon, they're always there. So it's such an obvious question that he must have an answer to it. Like, he was a smart man, and so he must have had an answer. I was looking in the Sefer, reading it and reading it. He never spoke about it. I can't imagine that it slipped his mind. I must be missing something, but that's another question that people have on Rav Yonos and Eibeshitz. All the other schools of thought take for granted that Likui Chama and Likui Levana refer to eclipses. So working with that assumption, the next, I guess, major answer is Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, the Aruch Laner, on that Gemara and Sukkah, he talks about it as well. Again, references the fact that people were making fun of it, and people said, oh, Chazal didn't know what they were talking about. And once again, he, as well as the Lubavitcher Rebbe, both say explicitly that back then they knew that eclipses were caused by shadows, by planetary movements, and in fact, they could calculate eclipses. If you go back to source number 7, this is published by NASA, by the last full solar eclipse, from 2017. So they talk about a Greek astronomer named Ptolemy from the year 150, so that's a little before the Mishnah was redacted, after Chorban Bayis, right after the Bar Kokhba revolt, basically. So around the time of Rav Yehuda, a little before Rav Yehuda Hanasi, in Egypt, in Alexandria, there was this guy named Ptolemy, and he recorded his observations of eclipses in the book, The Almagest, and showed he had a sophisticated scheme for predicting both lunar and solar eclipses. Ptolemy knew, for example, the details of the orbit of the moon, including its nodal points, and he also knew, if you turn the page, that the sun must be within 20 degrees of the node point for an eclipse to occur. From this information, Ptolemy figured that up to 2 solar eclipses could occur within 7 months in the same part of the world. And lunar eclipses were even easier. And so NASA argues, so by the 2nd century CE, meaning by the time the Mishnah was written, total solar eclipses could be predicted with reasonable accuracy. For a growing segment of the human population, there were no longer messages from hostile gods or supernatural forces, but simply an interesting regularity of the orbits of the moon and earth about the sun. So, assuming that Chazal were part of that cultural zeitgeist, which again, it's evident that they were, because they reference so many things about astronomy. They were clearly well-versed with the science of their times. You know, it's another theological question. Did Chazal know things that science didn't know at the time? That's a separate question. But it's very, very clear from Talmudic literature that in the areas where they lived, they were very well-versed in science, especially with things that impacted halacha, like astronomy, in terms of setting up the new moon and stuff like that. So clearly they knew this stuff. So it has to mean something else. So in source number 8, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, he suggests that it doesn't mean that our actions cause the sun, the eclipse to occur. But rather, the eclipse means now it's a time of judgment for those four things. I mean, the Gemara said for four things, the sun gets an eclipse. It doesn't mean that it causes the eclipse, but the other way around. The eclipse, the reason why Hashem created the phenomenon of eclipses was so that there would be a time of judgment for those four things. Why those four things? Shear for another time. But if you look at the bolded part in source number 8, he says, "Dehach bizman lashon miyutaru." The word zman is extra. Amnam bazehoru. What it means, they meant to highlight, sha'af sha'alakuyim heimal piteva. Even though eclipses are natural phenomenon, im kol zet, nevertheless, yadu al pisodos mishpatei Hashem haniglos lahem, they knew through Misora, you know, from Hashem's Torah, sha'itim v'hazmanim sha'alakuyim heim itos hadin, sha'yish itos letova v'itos lera. There are times that our tradition believes are auspicious or inauspicious times of judgment. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, for example, right? It's a time of judgment. It's not that our action, Hashem changes nature. No, Hashem said the natural world functions in a certain way, and I'm endowing that part of the natural world with a certain spiritual significance, saying, on Aleph Tishrei, it's a time of judgment. So similarly, there's nothing supernatural about an eclipse, but Hashem, for some reason, said, I'm making eclipses in the world, or I'm creating nature so that there's eclipses in order for that to be a time of judgment for those four Averos. I'm creating solar eclipses for it to be a time of judgment for the non-Jewish people, and I'm creating lunar eclipses as a time of judgment for the Jewish people. And he brings a proof from a case that we saw before. If you look at the second bold part, he says, Uke'en mashapirish haramban beparshas noach beosakeshes. And it's similar to what the Ramban says about rainbows. One of the questions that all the Mefarshim ask in Parshas Noach is, how could we say that there's some special significance about rainbows if rainbows are a natural phenomena? Hashem didn't create the rainbow by the flood. That those physics and optics existed beforehand. So there are different answers to that question, but what the Ramban says is, you're right, it was always there. Now what Hashem is saying is, I'm imbuing it with added significance. I'm saying now that for all time going forward, the rainbow will be a sign that I really don't like you guys, but I'm holding myself back because of the promise I made Noah. So it's not exactly analogous, but it's the same idea. That there's a pre-existing natural phenomenon that Hashem said, I'm associating with some deeper spiritual significance. That is probably, I would say, the most accepted answer to the question as to how the Gemara could say it's a bad sign. It doesn't mean that we caused it. What it means is that we have to be sensitive right now because it's a time of judgment for the Jewish or the non-Jewish people. That's, I would say, the most accepted answer. The Lubavitcher Rebbe gave a slightly different, I would say, more traditional answer. Because if you look at the language of the Gemara, and if you compare other Gemaras about astronomy, it really does sound like that there's a certain causativeness. Meaning the Aruch Laner is reversing it. It's not saying that the celestial bodies cause things to happen. It's that they're sort of a pre-recorded response to things that we would be doing anyway. But if you look at various Gemaras about astronomy, it seems like that astronomy has an impact on us. And so that's not what the Aruch Laner is saying. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe had a different answer, kind of in line with that other, zeitgeist of Chazal, that astronomy had some, for lack of a better term, deterministic elements to it. If you're born with a certain horoscope, so you're predisposed to something. So the classic Gemara that some of us may be familiar with, Moalim certainly are, that if you're born under the sign of Mars, you should become a Moel, a surgeon, a doctor, somebody that deals with blood, rather than becoming a serial killer. Meaning if you're born under a certain astronomical or astrological sign, there's a certain predisposition that you have. Now, obviously, we Jews believe that everybody has free choice. And especially when it comes to Jewish people, Ein Mazel LiYisrael, we have the power to transcend that predisposition. So if somebody has a predisposition for blood, so they can sublimate it to becoming a doctor or a moel or a dentist or somebody that works or a phlebotomist. I don't know, somebody that deals with blood or Zaka, you know, somebody that has to deal with these things. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe says that's what the Gemara means, that there's a certain predisposition in the world at that time. If you look, he says in source number 9, Pirish, Shel ha-ma'amar, kishah-ma'amaros, lokin, simin ra, when it means that the celestial bodies are eclipsed, it's a bad sign, vizos v'shvil al-arbedvarim, it's because of four averos, hushaka asher magia likoy me'oros, zehuzman, zehuzimin, shebizman zeh, sholeit mazal ra. It's a sign that there's a bad mazal in the world. And then he says in the next paragraph, lefichach, and so that's what the Gemara means when it says that the Jewish people, if they're doing what Hashem wants, they don't have to be afraid. It's not that Hashem doesn't bring them. It's that if you're doing what Hashem wants, if you're persevering over your own predisposition or the predisposition of the world at that time, you have nothing to fear. You have absolutely nothing to fear because we're above it. And then he continues, "Lefi ze ein makom l'sheila al kach shelikoy chama ulevana boim bizmanem kvuim." And therefore, we don't have to be, concerned about all the people that make fun of Chazal and say, "I don't have to keep mitzvahs anymore because they didn't know what they were talking about," because eclipses are natural phenomenon. Eclipses are not the product of human actions, but rather it's a sign for punishments. It's a sign that people will get punished for those four things. And there are those type of signs and dispositions are around in creation. Hashem made the world, or at least the Rebbe and understood that Chazal believed that there were certain, maybe what we would call supernatural phenomenon, but there are certain mazalos in the world that don't determine what we do, but can predispose us a certain way, and we have to, I guess, invest extra effort to tilt the scale the other way. So that's what I would say are the different answers to how we deal with the calculated part, the natural phenomenon part. The final third of the shiur is the historical part. We touched on some of it already, which is how did Jewish people deal or react to eclipses? So the vast majority of them took these Gemaras literally, that you need to be afraid, that we should be saying Tehillim. We should be davening. If you experience an eclipse, means that there's something bad on the horizon and we need to daven, do tshuva, and stuff like that. And there are instances about that. There was a major battle in World War I that was right before an eclipse. There was a major famine right before an eclipse. And you had different rabbanim saying, oh, this is going to be bad. We should daven. We should do say Tehillim. We should do tshuva. That's what I would say are the vast majority of responses based on this Gemara. Meaning even the Aruch HaNer and the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Yonasan and Eibeshitz, who all tried to deal with the natural phenomenon aspect of it, they still took it seriously that we have to, it's a time of reflection and tshuva. There's one exception to that, and that is the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim, and this was a solar eclipse, so it's a simin ra for the Umos HaOlam. So maybe you would say, the Chafetz Chaim said, we should celebrate because it's a bad sign for the non-Jews. No, Chafetz Chaim had a totally different take on it. If you turn to this page, if you pass the Hebrew halacha part, this is a photocopy of a journal called Beis Yaakov, which was an educational journal that was published in Eretz Yisrael, I believe. And there's an article, or honestly more of a memoir, by a person named Rav Shmuel Pliskin. Rav Shmuel Pliskin, if you turn the page, the rest of this packet is basically a translation of the bottom half of the Hebrew page. So if you turn the page, you can see Rav Shmuel Pliskin. I'm just going to change the screen over here so people can see that. So these are pictures of Rav Shmuel Pliskin. The one on the left is him as an adult, and the one on the right is a class photo of him in Europe on Purim. So everybody's dressed up. If you look, he's the one on the far right. He's the one not dressed up. So I don't know, maybe he was considered himself too old or he didn't like Purim. I don't know. Rav Shmuel Pliskin was a student in the Raden Yeshiva in Chafetz Chaim from 1925 to 1937. He later moved to Baltimore, and he was a major rabbinic figure in Baltimore. His son is Reb Zelig Pliskin, who wrote many, many books that some of you may be familiar with. He wrote a memoir when he was a student in Raden about a solar eclipse that occurred, and the Chafetz Chaim energized the people to experience it. Now, when this happened is a little bit of a debate. Based on current calculations, we think that it was June 29th, 1927. Based on various historical accounts and facts and calculations, the only problem with that is that if you do the reverse engineering the path of the eclipse, it wasn't a full eclipse over Raden. So we're not exactly sure when, but that's probably the closest date. So this was in the summer. He writes, it was a typical summer warm evening, a warm Tuesday, and the elderly Chafetz Chaim had just finished Aleinu. After placing his sitter down on the table, the Chafetz Chaim looked around, scanning the crowd which had packed the narrow room for Meiriv. He was davening at home. Finally, the Chafetz Chaim gave a clap on the edge of the table, and he began to speak. He says, if you go down to the bolded part, Hashem has implanted in creation the phenomenon of a solar eclipse as a means of refuting those misguided souls who believe in other immortal powers. The time comes when the sun is eclipsed so that we all know and internalize the sun is a creation and not a creator, and us mankind, we're no different. The Chafetz Chaim says that in the times of maybe the Gemara, in the times before the Gemara when Avodah Zarah was rampant, eclipse was a sign from Hashem to the world that the sun is not a god. Even the sun fades away. Now, we all know the story of Avram Avinu, that the Medrash says, oh, he looked at the sun, maybe he should bow down to the sun, then the sun set and the moon came up. He had his own way of dealing with that. But the Chafetz Chaim says the reason why Hashem initially made it that way was to disabuse pagans of the belief that the sun was all-powerful. Even at the time when it's supposed to be at its apogee, it could instantaneously disappear. But what does that mean to us, the Chafetz Chaim says? We don't believe in any of that stuff anymore. The Chafetz Chaim says that it's still relevant. It's to show us that we should not be afraid of any person or anything in the natural world, because just like the sun, which is the source of heat and energy and life in the world, even that can disappear for a minute and be reborn. Any human being, any animal, any wildlife can also, just with a flick of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's finger, can disappear. He says that's what we need to internalize. Once again, the Chafetz Chaim tapped on the table, and with an expression of triumph, he smiled and added, let them all come and see. Now, the Chafetz Chaim, this was very much the Chafetz Chaim's personality. The Chafetz Chaim would take a look at all the new technologies were emerging and saying, oh, the reason why Hashem made this was so that we could internalize this idea. The reason why we have photographs, the Chafetz Chaim says, is because we could remember, we can internalize v'chol ma'asecha b'sefer nechtavim, that an entire image can be stored for all posterity. That's why. Maybe for other reasons too. But the Chafetz Chaim said that's why Hashem made cameras. Why did Hashem make electricity? For us to understand how Hashem's flow of life and energy and tefillah can travel distances telegrams, how messages can be sent across the world, we can send them to Hashem as well. This was the same, this is the same Chafetz Chaim that's saying that. He's saying, look at this natural world. We should internalize it for us, even if the main reason why Hashem had made it beforehand may no longer be relevant. There's a new message for us. And he continued, it is a mitzvah for us all to come and to see with our own eyes, that the sun is only a mortal chunk of creation. The Chafetz Chaim tapped softly once again and smiled quietly. That caused a stir. The Chafetz Chaim was not the Rav of Radin, he wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva of Radin, but he was the Tzaddik of Radin, and everybody listened to him. And so when the Chafetz Chaim says, everybody's got to come out and see the sun and see the eclipse, everybody does. And the Chafetz Chaim spiritualized the experience. And so everybody made a whole avoda out of it. The crowd slowly filtered out of the room, deeply inhaling the cooler outdoor air while chattering about the upcoming event, the rare solar eclipse early the next morning. As lightning, the word spread throughout the entire village. In every house, the news was relayed. The Chafetz Chaim has announced it is a mitzvah to go and see the next morning's sensation. The search began. This was the old equivalent of eclipse glasses. They weren't being sold for $3 at Evergreen. The search began for broken shards of glass, usually a valueless commodity strewn about under one's feet, yet now a sought-after material in light of the upcoming event. They set out industriously, preparing their sophisticated equipment, blackening their glass shards with soot from a burning candle. So that's why the title was through ash-covered glasses, through an ash-colored lens. That's the point of what the Chafetz Chaim wanted to say. You're supposed to look at the world with dust or with a little bit of ash, that to embrace mortality, not as a sign of sadness, but that there's something above everything and one should not be afraid of it. And one should not be afraid of anything below HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I was actually at a funeral yesterday, and they were buried right near Rabbi Tendler. And so on Rabbi Tendler's tombstone, it says he was afraid of nobody. The only person or the only entity above him was Hashem, and that was the only being that he feared. And that's what the Chafetz Chaim was saying. You should not be afraid of anything, of anyone, except Hashem, because all of those Hashem could just flick away. And then he continues, morning came, seemingly another casual day, yet a sense of something different was in the air. The streets of Radin had never been as teeming. At such an early hour, men, women, children were all up and about. And the sun paraded along on its usual course with confident strides, ascending with all its prowess, a blazing sun beating down on the masses who had gathered on the marketplace and on the green treetops swaying in the distance. This is just a middle-aged man reminiscing about his childhood. And so he continues, the Chafetz Chaim was davening, and he was saying the brachos about Yotzer Or, of creating light with extra kavana. Now look at the bolded part. The sun's brilliance, the blinding glow, has now been replaced by brilliant red, the redness now overpowering, as if its heart had been deeply plunged and wounded. Likui chama. The huge solar sphere, in midst of its youthful bloom, had suddenly been cleaved. Fresh, youthful life slowly being chiseled away. Not the groaning sound of a dying old man. It was the powerful gush of blood, draining from the wound inflicted by a cannon shell. Darkness, the animals in the field frightened, while the eyes of the townsfolk sparkled from content and satisfaction. Again, what he's trying to do is say the natural world cowered, but because the Chafetz Chaim energized them, this was a mitzvah for them. They felt happy, despite the fact that life seemed to be coming to a halt. Then if you go to the next paragraph, here and there, groups formed on the porches and the bridges, peering through their blackened glass at the waning sun, now half-darkened. Near the yeshiva building as well stood groups of bachrim gazing upward. In the corner, near the blossoming cherry tree, whose white flowers were turning a reddish hue, stood Rev Naftali, the Rosh Yeshiva, that's the person next in the picture, intensely peering through his glass shard, with eyes deeply sunk in their sockets. With a fist he raised, he explained to those around him, Midarf nit kuken, midarf zen. One should not simply look, one should see and internalize what the Chafetz Chaim was saying. And if you look, this is a picture of the Rad in Yeshiva today, or about 10 years ago when I visited. This is a picture that I took. The building is still there. It's now a community center, but it's still around. There were Bachrim in 1927. So there were Bachrim there with Rav Naftali Trapp. It was summer, so no snow, but they were looking. And if you go to the bold part, the Chafetz Chaim gazed with awesome respect, the same way he quietly stared at his Hanukkah candles, not turning his gaze as long as the light still flickered. The courtyard of Yeshiva had turned into a veritable observatory. There was no peering through telescopes, but there was intense gazing through primitive blackened glass. And if you turn the page, this is the courtyard of the Yeshiva. Darkness descended on the entire sphere. It was as if a huge inkwell had blotched out the entire sun. It was an eerie darkness, not the darkness of dusk nor the darkness of midnight. A black screen stretched across the entire sun. And then the marveling spectacle. The sun is born once again, just as it happened during the 6 days of creation. Not suddenly, rather a slow growth as a child slowly developing. First a thin red sliver slowly widening, the bright red color slowly overpowering the darkness. Once again, red spills across the entire sphere, the redness of life, blood once again gushing through the arteries. The cherry tree once again goes back to its light-colored blossoms. In the fields, morning is once again promising. The birds beat their wings in flight with greater assurance, though still tinged with a bit of doubt. And mankind, small creatures, blink their eyes filled with satisfaction and contentment. The sun, once again in its full radiance, reclaims its prowess. And the Chafetz Chaim, he was too elderly to walk on his own. He was carried in a chair, and he motioned. It was over. It was time to go back in. So his son-in-law from that other picture on the Chafetz Chaim, Rav Mendel Zaks, who was a Rebbe in YU as well, he and some of the other town elders brought the Chafetz Chaim back into his house. But before, if you look at the last bolded part, the pure and holy saint stops at the simple wooden table in the middle of the room, and with an expression of victory amidst a joyous call, just a mortal creation. There are many other lessons, there are many other shiurim that we can talk about in terms of the significance of the eclipse in a theological sense, why those particular averos. But I think for us at this time, in the very dark days that we find ourselves in, I think this is the message that we should internalize. That as dark as the world seems, as evil as the people are, we should not be afraid. Why Hashem does things the way he does, we don't know. Maybe we'll never know. And we have to say, Baruch Dayan Ha'emes. And when we're trying to stave off bad things from happening, we're supposed to daven and say Tehillim. But what the Chafetz Chaim is saying is that we should never be afraid. And while the rest of creation may cower, we have bitachon, we look with contentment, with satisfaction, and with happiness at our avoda, and realize that everything around us are just mortal creations. And that should be a source of pride for us. And so wherever you're going to be during the eclipse, I think this is the idea that we should, maybe I could say a parak of Tehillim. If you want to say Osa Masa Bereishis without Shem HaMalchus, I think you also can do that. But what I think the primary idea that we should have for this particular eclipse is the Chafetz Chaim's idea that the sun is just a mortal creation. Everything else around us, Hamas, Hezbollah, any terrorist, they're all mortal creations. Why they sometimes seem to succeed, we don't know. But we shouldn't be afraid. And ultimately, it's a simon of judgment for the Ovdei Kochavim. And we have bitachon that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will stand up for us. We may not know exactly how and when and what form it'll take. But we have bitachon that Hashem will, and everything else is just a mortal creation. And so when we read Parshas HaChodesh, and Hashem says, HaChodesh Hazeh Lechem Rosh Chadashim, that you don't follow the solar calendar. You follow a lunar calendar, and we have the power to define when there's a new moon. And even when we make a mistake, God runs with it. We have the power to shape our own destiny, and we have the power to shape our destiny right now through davening, through Tehillim, through advocacy. If you haven't signed those letters through the OU or doing whatever else you need to do, please do them. We have the power to change our own destiny. And I don't think despite that, but in conjunction with that, the reason why we have the power to shape our own destiny is not because we're all powerful, but because, as the Gemara says, Osin Ritzono Shamakom, everything else is just a mortal creation. And so when you see that sun darken, whatever percentage occlusion you see, you should thank Hashem and daven to Hashem. But most importantly, you should just be proud and be happy and say, everything else around me is just a mortal creation, and Hashem is the one calling the shots. And in that schus of that bitachon, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should help us take control of our destiny. With Nisan being the Chodesh HaGeula, we should be zocha for the very, very physical geula of those that are still being held hostage. And it should be a geula for us as well, to come back to Eretz Yisrael with Mashiach and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Have a good evening.